And you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming on WPKN.org. Welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com, and you can check us out on Facebook and see our videos on the In Context Report channel on YouTube. With me in the studio today are my fellow host, Gus Cantavero.
Hello.
And In Context military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe.
Good afternoon to all of WPKN's worldwide listeners.
As this is the last Monday of the month, we devote the entire program to our monthly war report, in which we analyze recent developments in the global war. In Context War Report is the only show of its kind on radio or TV, and we're very grateful to you, our listeners, for your generous donations to WPKN, which make it possible. And, of course, you can go onto our website, WPKN.org, anytime and make a tax-deductible donation to keep the station on the air. Among the developments we're going to look at in today's war report are the September 11th assassination of the U.S. ambassador to Libya, the violent response to the anti-Muslim film, The Innocence of Muslims, and the recent military moves in the Pacific by China. So, Marchand, let's start with the assassination of U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other staff members at the U.S. Embassy in Libya. The Obama administration started with the assumption that the attack was a protest that got out of hand. Now it characterizes the incident as a terrorist attack, and the Obama administration is even looking into the possibility that the attackers had inside help. What's your take?
Well, I mean, looking at this attack, one of the things that strikes me, and looking at the administration's reporting of it, one thing that strikes me as odd is that the day after the attack, actually the night after the attack, U.S. time, I was reading the American press, and they were all saying, well, you know, this is a spontaneous riot that just got out of hand, which seemed a little weird for me, considering ambassadors typically travel with Secret Service and Marines. The fact that this ambassador is in a war zone by himself seemed odd enough as it is. The fact that he was left so vulnerable with no guards seemed really strange. Then I read the Israeli press, which almost immediately said that the attack was orchestrated by Al-Qaeda. It was an organized operation using 20-some-odd operatives, 20 elite commandos. And now this is beginning as a military affairs expert. Right, as a subject matter expert in this, I looked at how the Israelis described the attack, and to me it was very well planned, very well orchestrated. I mean, this is something that it got a bunch of goofballs with rocks and AK-47s couldn't have pulled this off. 10 commandos launch an attack on the front gate of the consulate, right? And this is to draw attention. This is a diversionary attack. It sends the Libyan guards, who they know are poorly equipped and poorly trained, running for their lives. The ambassador and his handful of Secret Service, three Secret Service agents, go to get into their escape vehicle. Now, the attackers knew the consulate's TTPs. They knew what their standard operating procedures were in the event of an attack, which was to flee the consulate. In many consulates or embassies, they have a safe room where they will throw the ambassador in there, lock the door until the Marines arrive. Well, they knew that the ambassador was going to flee. So 10 other Al-Qaeda operatives behind a wall of the embassy waited for the ambassador to come out. And the moment the ambassador came out, they jumped the wall and ambushed him, threw him and his security up against the wall and shot him. Now, this was very well orchestrated, very well timed. They lay down suppressive fire. This is the kind of thing where you have to spend weeks, if not months, with rock drills, sand table drills, battle drills, where you're, you know, rehearsing over and over and over again. And you needed a guy on the inside to tell you when the ambassador was leaving. It had to be timed. It had to go off without a hitch.
This was done by a pros. They were practiced. They practiced this. They probably had inside information. Then the question is, who did it? And according to recent press reports, the U.S. government is now looking at groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, a branch that originated in Algeria. And one extremist now under scrutiny is a former detainee at Guantanamo Bay, a guy named Hamouda, a Libyan who was a prominent member of an extremist group called Ansar al-Sharia. They don't know. They're looking at Al-Qaeda, but doesn't sound like to me that they have any really good leads.
Well, the Americans don't have any good leads. This is what strikes me as bizarre. Okay, so a day after the attack, I, through reading the Israeli press, Haaretz, the main Israeli newspaper, that is the New York Times of Israel, reading Debka, the Israeli intelligence agency, reading other Israeli sources, I knew as a civilian that how the attack was implemented, that it was Al-Qaeda, that it was Ayman al-Zawahiri ordered it personally, and the American...
Who is he?
He is now the head of Al-Qaeda, took over after bin Laden's death. And I knew, and the Israelis knew, right off the bat, it's Al-Qaeda, this is all the information. The American press takes weeks to play, well, a week, I should say, to play catch-up and say, well, okay, it was spontaneous. No, the Israelis are wrong. They've got to be wrong. I mean, the Mossad is not reliable. Why would they be reliable? If I may, just really quick. So I think the reason why the Americans are playing catch-up, this attack was too well organized to be a spontaneous uprising. The very notion is ludicrous. We can discount that right off the bat. This is what we're looking at. We're treating this like a crime scene. In college, I studied criminal justice. Treating this like a crime scene, you have to look at who has motive, who has opportunity, and who has the means. So looking at this, a spontaneous uprising, utterly ludicrous. Let's cancel that out right away. Al-Qaeda? Well, if it was Al-Qaeda, we supposedly watch Al-Qaeda very thoroughly. How come the Israelis knew about this and we didn't? And then you look at who had motive, opportunity, and the means to pull it off. And the people I implement in this is the Mossad. And the reason is because if you imagine your house burns down, right? Mm-hmm. Your house burns down. And the police department show up and they say, well, we don't know who did this. But some guy who you know, who's your friend, who lives on the other side of the country, tells you, oh, I know exactly who did it, how they did it, and why. Wouldn't you be just a little suspicious of how did you know this before I did?
Al-Qaeda, as we've covered in the show, it's hard to know where Al-Qaeda begins and the CIA ends.
Yeah, that's true. And let's not also forget that the Google, which is what first spread this controversial video, Innocence of Muslims, that Google itself owns YouTube and is a CIA-NSA front organization, started with NSA plant money going back to the beginning. And YouTube routinely censors videos that contains offensive speech and material by American journalists. Like, you know, even Alex Jones has had a lot of videos censored on there because it contains, quote, hate speech. But yet they allow this video to stay on there untouched despite all of the protests that it sparked.
13 million views. 13 million approximately.
For a terrible, terrible, low-budget, ridiculous joke of a video.
It's absurd. And the other thing that strikes me as odd, too, is that the video supposedly, for anybody who hasn't seen it, and as Gus mentioned, absurdly cheap, cost $5 million to make, and it's not being removed from YouTube. Somehow cost $5 million
to make. And that's a joke. It's only like 14 minutes. The whole video is not up there. I don't think there exists a whole video. And it looks like a ridiculous, poorly done thing against a blue screen.
It's a bunch of idiots.
Well, Marge, you and I did find a full one. It was like an hour and 18 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Did you? Yeah.
But I mean, the piece that's up there has 13 million hits.
No, YouTube has the trailer. That's the trailer. Right. YouTube has the whole video.
Right, but the trailer with 13 million hits looks like something somebody made in a garage.
With bathrooms.
So does the whole video. The whole movie looks like that.
So $5 million.
What strikes me especially as especially absurd is the fact that YouTube, as a military historian, I've done a lot. I do a lot of independent research into, you know, looking on YouTube into like unedited footage from you know, whether it's World War II or, you know, even if I can find, if I'm lucky enough, World War I or even the present wars, and they routinely, as Gus mentioned, censor, you know, videos from the front. They censor military videos. In fact, the so-called Marine video where it was the guys peeing on the dead Afghans, YouTube took that off right away as offensive. And then, of course, if you look for one of my favorites is, you know, if you go to type in anything relating to, particularly Hitler, if you're talking about World War II, you can't find it. It's like, I mean, you can find it, but the search bar doesn't have any recommendations. But this video, for some reason, as is probably one of the most heinous, offensive things I've ever seen, but it's not censored.
Yeah, no problem. That one can stay up. The point of this, the reason I bring this up, is because it now gives all those disgusting monsters, enemies of the Republic out there, like Hillary Clinton, to go around saying, well, that's the cost of our free speech. You know, to for us to be able to have free speech, this kind of stuff is going to be out there, and tough noogies, that's just the way it is. People go and say, maybe we should get rid of our free speech.
Let me circle back then to the question. You're suggesting that the attack on the U.S. ambassador in Libya was state-sponsored. And how about this film? Is there state sponsorship of this film? It's not a couple radical copped Christians who are virulently anti-Islamic. There's something, a bigger hand behind here?
Not at all. I'm certain there's a bigger hand because the Coptic Church condemned it. Now, the Coptics have, you know, when I was in Egypt, one thing I saw is the Coptics have no love for the Muslims. They really don't. I mean, you know, but they have to live together. They're forced to live together. And ultimately, you know, a Coptic knows if he goes out and makes a film like this, it'll result in riots, which might get Coptics killed. The same way Muslims in Egypt know that if they go out and make anti-Coptic films, the Coptics will kill Muslims. So there's a very fine balance. The Coptic Church condemned it. They had no interest in this video coming out. So I think the only people who would, you have to start looking towards especially the Israelis. I mean, to me, the Israelis seem like the number one suspect because they're the most frustrated with Obama in terms of they want an attack now. Obama's not defending the Republic. He wants an attack Iran. He wants to attack Iran too, but he just wants to wait till after the election, after he's won.
Just to back up to the listeners who may not know, the film was supposedly made by a guy named Nakula under the assumed name of Sam Basil. And this Nakula guy had been convicted of many crimes. He'd been in and out of jail, and he was actually cooperating with federal authorities on a sting in an extensive check kiting scheme. Okay, that's his background. And it was supposedly, and he was a copt living in California. And then it was supposedly publicized through the internet by a guy named Morris Sadek, who was an Egyptian cop and is supposed to be virulently anti-Islamic. Now, how he managed to leverage he's probably a pretty obscure guy, into this extensive exposure in the media, how the heck did that happen?
He's the one that actually pulled the permit to make the movie. So I believe he's the one that's actually in charge. The one, Sam Basile, the alias Sam Basile,
Nakula,
he, I think, is just a face to this. I don't think he really is.
But then who is the Sadek working for?
That's the good question.
that's what we're trying to figure out.
Because how does this guy? I mean, you and I could make I'd like to think we get 13 million hits on our in context videos. But suppose this guy Sadek sent out a bunch of emails to journalists, and overnight he's got, you know, global
coverage.
Well,
is he the one with the Israeli intelligence ties?
Well, I believe he does. I mean, it would make sense. It would also make sense. How did they get him to do it? Well, they pay him $5 million. The film costs, let's say, $1,000 at most, a couple thousand to make. And then he basically pockets $4 million in change, you know. Mm-hmm. And then with that money, I mean, especially, you know, if he just, you know, goes wherever he goes, you know, whether it's California or just, you know, leaves the country altogether, $4 million's a hell of a lot of money just to make some crappy movie. So I think he was paid off to do it.
So it's a black op on top. You know, the assassination is a black op. The film was a black op, and maybe even all these protests, a lot of them around the Mideast, are being incited by agents.
Well, don't forget, no one even saw this movie until there was the assassination of Stevens, the ambassador. Nope. No one even saw it until then. Then all of a sudden it got all those views. And so one begot the other.
Exactly. And that's why I think when you look at it, when you look at the entire incident as a whole, as one big crime scene, the people who would potentially benefit the most from it, the people who had the most motive, because certainly Obama didn't benefit from this. It makes him look a right pig's ear. And the people who would have the means to pull it off, I mean, my number one suspect is the Israelis.
Well, now, to back up again, we have been covering for months Israeli pressure on the Obama administration to join it in a war on Iran.
Yeah.
And Obama, even just last night in 60 Minutes, indicated he wasn't going to go for it. Mm-hmm. And so the Israelis are pressing him hard. What you say makes some sense. What about China? What about Russia? They're also adversaries of the U.S.
China and Russia benefit very well from this. And I always hear, well, China and Russia, they don't want to get into it with the U.S. They're frightened of us. You know, we are the number one debtor to China. You know, well, let's never stop countries from going to war before. I mean, heck, Henry Ford sold parts to Germany during World War II. You know, he made parts for Jeep and he made parts for Germany during the war. So I wouldn't put it beyond China to view a war as an opportunity because they'd finance us, they'd finance the Russians, and they'd ramp up their own armaments industry.
Yeah, and those factors are the only ones that were off limits to the Air Force to bomb.
Exactly. Little known fact, but the United States Air Force or Army Air Corps at the time did not bomb the factories that were owned by Henry Ford.
Oh, yeah.
But be that as it may, you know, that's another perfect example. So I think for the Chinese and the Russians, they're ready to go. They want to knock us off our pedestal. They want to kick us out of the Middle East. They want to kick us out of the Far East. Last night, I read in Press TV a report that Chinese naval vessels have entered Japanese territorial waters. Now, the Japanese have no military, so to speak. They have the Japanese Self-Defense Forces, which is like less than 500,000 men in its total, in its entirety. So the Japanese have gone to Obama to say, for the love of God, tell the Chinese to back off. And the Chinese were not intimidated. And this incident, the killing of the U.S. ambassador, the riots all across the Middle East, are an indictment of the fact that the world views the U.S. as weak. So for China and Russia, this is the propaganda they need. Look, the U.S., as Mao once said, is a paper tiger. We can bring him down. And so Russia is ramped up its support for Assad, which who they already supported to the hilt in Syria. They've ramped up their support for Iran, and Iran is now threatening to launch a preemptive strike. Their own military is threatening to launch a preemptive strike on Israel. Now, this is also an escalation on the Iranian part, too. The Iranians have said, well, in the event of a war, we will – first they say, in the event of a war, we will pummel Israel. And then Obama said to Iran, look, in the event of war, we will not support Israel. Then Iran said, well, even if you don't support Israel, all U.S. military bases and vessels in the Middle East are targets. If we get attacked by Israel, we will attack your interests whether you're involved or not. And then today, Israel said – or I'm sorry, Iran said, in the – you know – If we just so much as see Israel preparing for war, we will launch a preemptive strike. Because they know, and the Russians are telling them, Ahmadinejad, the head of Iran, doesn't make a decision without Vladimir Putin giving the go-ahead. The Russians have made the call, the Iranians have made the call, the Chinese have made the call, that we are in a very weak, very vulnerable position now.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport. And this is our monthly war report. We're on every Monday, except the first Monday from noon to 1. And every month, on the last Monday of the month, we devote the entire show to a review of recent developments in the global wars. And we try to look behind them to see how what it amounts to in terms of the geo-global the global political strategy of the main players, the United States, Russia, China, and try to connect it all. And
Ken, you want to give out the email address?
And our email address, if you want to drop us a note, a question, or a comment on the discussion, write to ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org, and we will get your email and read it on the air. And in a couple of minutes, I'll give out the phone number so you can call in. Marshawn, we're focusing right now on the fallout from the film, this film, Innocence of the Muslims, about the turmoil that's going on in the Mideast. There have been recent moves by the military of Israel in the Golan Heights. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes. Now, this is something that that shocked most most military analysts, and certainly shocked most of the nations in the region. The Israelis spontaneously, without warning, launched an unscheduled live fire military exercise on the border with Israel. With Israel, Lebanon, and Syria along the Golan Heights, and they moved in a tremendous amount of troops. This live fire exercise was preparing to, they claim, repel an invasion. It looked a lot more like to implement an invasion, you know, from the outside at least. And which might have been part of the idea. After the exercise is over, they said, oh, don't worry. This was part of a pre-scheduled exercise. We just didn't want anybody to know about it. It's a little weird, but the what's...
exercise for a surprise attack.
Exactly. Exercise for a surprise attack. So we right. just, we don't, we surprise our own people.
Don't mind us.
Exactly. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. But what strikes me as bizarre is that this supposed exercise, they don't withdraw their troops. Typically you go conduct a military exercise, you occupy a bit of land, you blow some stuff up, and then you go home. Mm. These guys didn't go home.
It's like
they
inviting yourself over to a party and then not leaving.
Exactly. And so they've kept these forces on the Golan Heights, on the border with Lebanon. They've also started moving troops down onto the border with Sinai and militarized that border, because the Sinai border has been very quiet up until this video and this incident with the shooting of the ambassador. Most this was not played at all in the American press. I got this from the Egyptian press, Al-Ahram Weekly. I got this from Debka. I got this from Haaretz. American media, total blackout. Right after the killing of the ambassador and, you know, the riots with the video, a group calling itself the Islamic Army of the Sinai, they also call it Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, which means victory to Jerusalem. The Ansar Beit al-Maqdis and the Islamic Army of Sinai launched an attack on the international base, the multinational forces, which includes 1,500 U.S. troops in the Sinai. They killed four, I believe, killed or wounded four, and ripped apart the armory and had the U.S. troops there under siege for several days. No play in the U.S. media. They also attacked three Egyptian military.
You think that'd be big news, too.
You think so.
What are U.S. troops doing in the Sinai?
They're part of the U.N. peacekeeping force there.
Okay, so the idea is to keep Israel and Egypt from fighting each other. We've contributed troops to
Sinai. Yes, the same way we have peace, we had peacekeepers in Lebanon and things like that. But so, and then in addition to that, again, you think that would be big news. Of course, there's a media blackout because the Obama administration doesn't want to look like, you know, they already look weak. They want to delude the American people. The rest of the world knows we're very vulnerable right now. They're just trying to delude the American people.
But not just vulnerable, everywhere. Like, we're spread so thin, we're just in every continent. We're on stretch of grass and dirt and sand and mountaintop.
And yet there seems to be resistance at the highest levels in the U.S. military expanding the war. Is that not right?
American public heard, though, that why are soldiers dying in Sinai? I thought we were in Afghanistan and Iraq. You know,
exactly.
These are not anything to do with each other.
That's why it's kind of like looking at the Soviet Union. It's kind of like if you were to transport yourself back to the Soviet Union, you know, where they're just like, things are getting so bad, we're just not going to talk about it
anymore. It seems like there's a fight between Dempsey and some of the more aggressive people in the administration.
That's all for show. And I'll explain that in a second. But in addition to the attack on the U.S. base, there were attacks on three Egyptian military bases where they wiped out these Islamic fighters who were supported by the Bedouins, the tribesmen of the region, wiped out three Egyptian army bases, killed or routed the entire force of the base, and, you know, raised the jihadi flag over the base, the black flag. And it was well coordinated. They decimated the Egyptian army, and they brought a tremendous amount of firepower to bear. They also killed 16 Egyptian special forces, and the Egyptian special forces are trained by our Navy SEALs, so these guys are no joke. Which means also the people they're fighting are, my guess, very well trained, very well coordinated, and these guys may be it is believed to be forces backed by Russia and Iran, and possibly China as well. So what we're looking at here is an attack on all U.S. interests, but also an aggressive attack on U.S. military interests around the world, and an aggressive attack on our allies' military interests.
Egypt's in a very awkward position, longtime recipient of a couple $1 billion a year of U.S. aid, and now they have a new Islamic government that's trying to become more friendly with Iran. If a war breaks out, where would Egypt be?
Egypt would most likely, and this is what the Israelis are frightened of, fall on Iran's side. And that's one of the reasons why there's this impetus to attack Iran. They see that Egypt's getting closer to Iran. The more weak the U.S. gets, Egypt cut a deal with Iran for Egypt to buy missiles from Iran. So they see Iran's getting much tighter with Egypt. They see that Lebanon Lebanon's an extension of Iran. Hezbollah is an extension of the Iranian army. Syria, Assad is winning. So Israel sees very rapidly they're getting hemmed in. And in addition, Dempsey, to an extent, is probably worried about overextending U.S. forces, but he gets his marching orders from Obama, and that's what I was going to mention on the side. Dempsey was put in that position because he doesn't rock the boat. The man who should have gotten that job was General David Petraeus, but Petraeus is a man of an independent mindset. He is very well educated. He's a West Point graduate. This guy is probably, I would like to say, think the next Norman Schwarzkopf. He's a brilliant military commander, but he's also not above telling Obama the truth. Dempsey and Casey, who was the chief of staff beforehand, would tell Obama, this won't work, we can't do this.
Well, Petraeus must have known the surge wasn't going to work either, though, right? Well, he oversaw that.
And that's what Petraeus had said. Petraeus had said, look, this is what we need. We need to provide, and I read Petraeus' book, Counterinsurgency. He said, you have to provide long-term security. You can't, you know, surges, not yet. You have to have 500,000 men to provide long-term security. And so it really, Petraeus would tell Obama the truth. He put Dempsey there because Dempsey was a yes man. And Dempsey pretends to stand up to Israel because Obama's telling him to.
Right. If you just tuned in, you're listening to The War Report, a monthly review of the global war on the series In Context, which is on Mondays from noon to one. My name is Ken. I'm here with Gus and Marchand, our military affairs commentator. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a ring at 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756. Maybe you saw the 60 Minutes interview with President Obama. How do you feel about his not meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu, who's coming into New York for the General Assembly meeting of the United Nations? Obama was long anticipated that they'd have a big powwow with this Iran crisis building, but Obama's not going to meet with him. What do you think about Obama's hinting that he's really not going to support Israel if it attacks Iran, at least at this time? What do you think about the election and how the foreign policy, the global war, may impact the election? So give us a ring. Tell us what you think. 203-336-9756. You had mentioned the surge in Afghanistan, and the New York Times ran an article this week saying the surge is now over. The 33,000 troops Obama added have been withdrawn. I think we're down to 68,000 troops are supposed to be withdrawn over the next 2 years. And the phrase that comes to my mind, to people who are old enough, is Vietnamization. This kind of a attempt at peace with honor. We're going to turn the war over to our allies and try to get out the door before they collapse.
I think a lot of what it is we're trying to get more of our troops. I think unlike Vietnamization, where we were really trying to distance ourselves, you know, peace with honor. Let's just get out of here without looking
like
a bunch
of jerks.
That was
Nixon, for those who remember, in the early 70s.
Yeah, let's get it. But also, Nixon ramped up the bombing of North Vietnam while he was withdrawing, and he brought North Vietnam to the Paris Peace Conference. What had ultimately cost the United States the war at the end of the day and cost South Vietnam the war was the Watergate. Because when Watergate happened, Congress took away Nixon's power to act and ended the bombings of North Vietnam. And North Vietnam felt now they had the momentum because the bombings made a huge difference and allowed us to begin withdrawing our troops. We're not quite in that position in Afghanistan, but I think really what we want to do in Afghanistan, we want to withdraw our troops and we're shipping them to the Persian Gulf, which also shows how disingenuous Obama's promise of I'm making American interests a priority. It's all a load of.
So where are the troops going? Are they going to Kuwait? Are they going to
Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Egypt? Israel, in fact, actually, we have something like 5,000 U.S. troops in Israel. And we have about 15,000 in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the Persian Gulf. We also have, like, I believe it's 3 carrier battle groups there, which is the reason why we're not standing up to China. China is shipping in its fleet into Japanese, sailing its fleet into Japanese waters right now, and we're doing nothing. And a lot of that's because most of our ships are in the Persian Gulf. So Obama's completely disingenuous.
Talk about that Japanese-China dispute. What are they arguing over?
Oh, well, what they're fighting over is there are a series of islands off the coast of the southern coast of Japan called the Japanese call them the Senkaku Islands, the Chinese call them the Diaoyu Islands. They are claimed by China as historically Chinese. They're nominally nominally privately owned by Japanese families that lived there. It was very, very tiny populations. China wants them because they have natural gas. That really is the big reason why China wants them. China, as it stands, has no natural resources.
Nobody just wants to own rocks.
Exactly.
That's always what's under the rocks.
It's the same reason why Britain and the Irish Republic always fight over the island of Rockall, only because there's natural gas under it.
Yeah.
And that is fundamentally why China's so interested. And one thing people forget, when they always say, well, China wouldn't risk war and things like that, China right now is risking war. And the reason is because they have no natural resources. And without natural gas and without oil, China's economy is really motoring. They're moving forward. If they become dependent on the U.S. for oil and natural gas, or on the rest of the world for oil and natural gas, that means they are no longer self-sufficient. And that means the rest of the world can hold them hostage and say, we want to wreck your economy, we're going to cut off the natural gas.
Could China actually... I know that they have the manpower, they have the technology, they have all different kinds of stuff we've talked about many times before. Could they really survive a war without the oil supply?
Not really, which is why in the event of war, it's crucial for them to have allies like Sudan, to have good relations with Iran, and to have a strong influence in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan because they need that oil. They need that natural gas, which is also why in the event of a major war, the primary targets for a Chinese army would be like the Aleutian Islands off the coast of Alaska. It would be the Philippines. It would be Japan because they need that natural gas. And that oil. And the other thing that the Japanese need, you know, is they need breathing room. I mean, I hate to quote Adolf Hitler on that.
You mean Chinese.
Chinese, I'm sorry. The Chinese need breathing room. I hate to quote Adolf Hitler on that one, but he said, you know, the German people need breathing room. That's what the Chinese believe they need because they have 1.4, I believe, billion people crammed into a tiny landmass. And the problem is they're running out of land, they're running out of jobs, they're running out of food, they're running out of fuel, and they're running out of women. It sounds really medieval, but they are. There's something like 50 million Chinese men who can't marry because they don't have enough women. Now, the problem that this creates in any country, especially a developed one, is massive amounts of political unrest. So what has been the solution throughout history to this kind of crisis, throughout human history? It has been to launch a major war. Russia, by extension as well. Now, Russia has oil and natural gas. They would want a war for different reasons. They want to have hegemony in the Middle East and hegemony over Europe.
Let me ask Augustus. That's a very interesting point, Marshawn. Do you think that in the United States and maybe throughout the West, there's a similar faction that sees a big war as a solution to this? It seems to be intractable economic slump we're in.
I wouldn't think that there's any of the population that believes that they want to go to war.
I'm thinking the leadership in the leadership.
Oh, sure. yeah, I think that. Especially the power structure in the United States that wants to do away with things like the Constitution because it's just so pesky and in the way, you know, that they just would love to start a prolonged war. I mean, just look at what the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, points out as the number one threat to America. It's the domestic extremist. It's the white jean wearing, you know, guy with a John Deere hat and a beard. That
Oklahoma City bombing and all that. Randy Weaver.
The Operation Tripwire handouts that they produced for each of the different kinds of small businesses out there, like coffee shops, farm supply stores, gun stores, food production cafes. It's,
for those who aren't familiar, what is Operation
Tripwire? Operation Tripwire is, like I'm describing it, these flyers that they handed out to local establishments saying to look out for signs of a domestic extremist.
And this is coming from the
Department
FBI?
Of Homeland Security. Oh, right.
Somebody
who has recently purchased
to buy a coffee.
Right. Someone has recently purchased 1.4 billion rounds of ammunition, the same number of people in China. They've bought enough ammunition to shoot every American 3 times. And the Department of Homeland Security is gearing up for a war, but it's not with a war with China. It's a war with the American people. It's very disturbing and shocking to a lot of people out there, but it's what else could they be buying 1.5 billion rounds of ammunition for? And it's not for target practice.
Do you think it's because they anticipate huge unrest because the economy's not getting better? Or do you think it might be also because if they launch a larger war, expecting opposition?
Both. I think the American government believes that a war is a convenient way to transition the unrest with the American economy and the government's non-compliance with law. And just take any of those people who are not happy and remove them from the population, those able-bodied Americans who are able to actually,
resist
and do something for themselves, and just and redirect that.
You could also put in economic controls like you had in World War I. You could rationing, wage and price controls, and people would just accept it.
At that time, though, people actually thought that we were doing this for the good of the country.
Right.
And now I think we all understand that we're bankrupt, we can't afford any more wars, and that we don't really face a legitimate outward threat anymore, and that they're doing this purely just to redirect anger.
But I think you hit it right on the head. Oh, excuse me. Sorry, gas. Mm-hmm. But I feel like there's a GasX commercial there. But anyway, I think you hit it right on the head. There is a tremendous amount of – it's very similar to World War II, a tremendous amount of potential for redirection of frustrations, redirection of anger, and readjusting of our economic structure and our political structure. Because once you have a war, all gloves are off. I mean, World War II, I was reading that – you know, in spite of FDR's New Deal, had we not gone to war, the U.S. economy would have slipped back into the Great Depression. But what allowed us to emerge from it was the economic controls, having all of our surplus unemployed population in the military, and creating all of these jobs in the armaments industry, as well as the fact that we won the war. So the victor goes the spoils.
Yeah, that was just a series of redirections in, you know, during and post-World War II. I mean, all the fundamentals for a bad economy still existed, but all the layers of price control and funneling of resources to different segments of the population just helped to mask the basic problem. So we transitioned away from free market economy into this crony capitalist fascist economy, which we discussed on the last program, and created the military-industrial complex, which then launched us into the age of war, basically. It's the American
war.
The American century of war. You know, and this all started with the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, which allowed for the unlimited creation of credit for the American government to spend on adventurism.
Sure. And that's precisely why the moment World War II ends, like, no sooner does Germany surrender than we launch the Cold War. You know, we don't try to reconcile with the Soviets, and then Korea, Vietnam. You know, so we had to, because again, another thing I also read said that had we simply just ended the war and started to draw down our armaments industry, you know, draw down all this heavy industry we created, and, you know, bring all the men home from the front, we would have been right back to where we started before World War II. So we had to keep all these men in uniform. We had to keep the armaments industry going. We had to keep the fear up. Because we had the fear up, we could also squash dissent.
Yeah. And we also had unrest amongst the soldiers. So we had to give them the GI Bill and, you know, and then send them to college.
Pretty scary. Have all these millions of guys coming home who've killed a lot of people. And you're going to tell them there's no work for you?
Yeah.
I don't think so. If you just joined the show, this is you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're doing our monthly review of the global wars. We call it the War Report. And my name is Ken. I'm here with Gus and Marchand, our military affairs commentator. And you're welcome to join our conversation. Tell us what you think about how the war may be playing out in the election. Do you approve of Obama's restraint, apparent restraint regarding Israel's desire to attack Iran? Do you sympathize with Romney, who thinks we should be more aggressive? Let us know what you think by calling 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756, or you can drop us an email with question or comment to Ken at mdrtalk.org.
Well, and that's why, I mean, to kind of bring it back full circle now with that historical perspective, to bring it back to the modern, to the present day, I should say, to bring it back to the present day, we find ourselves in the same position. We also have rivals for dominance and power the same way we had Germany and Japan and Italy. During World War II, we now have China and Russia. And I think the powers that be have acknowledged that this is – every military analyst is saying this. Every general is saying this, from the Israeli Defense Forces to the Russian chief of staff to the chief of staff of the Iranian army to even, you know, General Dempsey. The next major war will spark World War III. If we go to war with Iran, it will spark World War III.
And, you know, it's a lot like parallel to World War I, which was really over, I learned from William Engdahl, who we've had on the show a couple of times, about oil. I never thought about it, but the Germans were building a railroad from Berlin to Baghdad, would have given them direct access to Middle Eastern oil, and the British could not allow that railroad to be completed because it would have made the British Navy irrelevant. Similarly, as you point, China is trying to get access to African oil. Libya was in Libya. They have ties with Iran. They're building a strategic set of bases towards the Mideast to ensure the supply of oil.
They have troops,
and we don't want
it to go
through.
Pakistan. That's something that's very little known to Americans. Is China has a couple thousand Chinese People's Liberation Army soldiers in Pakistan.
Whoa,
guys, we have a call. This is. Hold on a second. Let me pull it up. Let's see. Okay, this is Derek from Bethel.
Hi, Derek. You're on the air.
Maybe not.
Hello.
Hold on. Derek, are you with us? Hey, what the heck? What did I do wrong?
Oh, hold on.
Garrett, got you now. Go ahead.
Hi, Derek.
I'm not Derek.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I'm Michelle from Carver, Long Island.
Hi, right, Michelle.
I have an engineer in a couple of months, so I'm screwing everything up. Go ahead. Derek, call back. I hung up on you.
Hi, Michelle, what's on your mind?
I don't really have much of a comment other than I feel like the proverbial veil has been lifted and my eyes are opened because these are so many things that I'm aware of.
And, say that again. You broke up.
Okay.
Yeah, I think your phone's breaking up on it. We're going to have to let you go. Derek, is that you now?
Yes, it is.
All right, go ahead.
Hi, Derek.
Sorry for hanging up on you.
Michelle, give us a ring back, Michelle, if you can get your phone straightened out.
I'm really enjoying your, you know, you guys' talk and conversation today. And as far as the, you know, our presidents and the people running for president, I think that they really should not base what they do on winning votes and do what's really right for the country. And that's and a lot of times that gets pushed aside to do what's right for their election. And I really think that we need to, as a country, we need to rethink what's important to us. And it's not just people who, you know, the people who are in office, but everybody living in this country needs to rethink what is important.
Derek, do you think we need a rethinking of our foreign policy?
I think we need a rethinking across the board.
How would you like to see it changed?
I don't know if at this point it could change. I don't know if we're too far too far gone. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think it's hard to climb down. You know, we've got over 700 military bases around the world. These commitments. Hard to climb down.
When you said we were spread too thin before, it really hit home with me. I said, man, if anything were to happen today, we really would be spread too thin. And it's not the smartest idea for a country to do, you know?
Well, and, one of the things that reminds me of is I read an article in the Army Times not that long ago that said that if there was any major crisis anywhere in the world, the U.S. military wouldn't have the ability to respond to it because our troops are spread way too thin. For an army of just less than a million spread over 700 bases around the world, I mean, in the event of a crisis at home or abroad, we are probably in the most vulnerable position we've ever been.
Yeah, I think I think they're trying to play a chess game, and they're trailing, and they're not playing the right game right now. I feel that our government really needs to rethink what is important to them, to us as a country, and not the bottom line. I think there's more to it than that, and their heads are in the wrong places. Everybody's. I mean.
Well, thank you very much for your call, Derek. Appreciate you listening too.
And I think that gets back to, you know, like Derek said. I mean, I think it gets back to one of the fundamentals. We don't want to be playing the empire game with countries that have been at it for a hell of a lot longer than we have. Russia was an empire before we were even a colony, and you know, China was an empire before there were Indians here. So, I mean.
Let me just give out the phone number again. If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context. We're doing the monthly war report, which we do on the last Monday every month on our noon to 1 p.m. Monday show. And we'd like you to join the conversation. Our phone number is 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756. Do you agree with our last caller, Derek, that we really need a fundamental rethinking of U.S. foreign policy? And if so, what do you think it should be?
And I think we have to look towards what is best for the country. And I think that's part of the problem. And that's why we need a serious restructuring of our entire political system, because all anyone's concerned about, whether it's the congressmen or the senators, whether it's the president, whether it's any of our elected officials, all they're concerned with is getting reelection. And we as the people have to tell them, look, unless you're going to put what we want, the interests of the American people first, we're not going to vote for you, because that in of itself is a huge problem, you know, in terms of, like you say, climbing down from this. And we also have to realize the implications if we don't.
Well, we had Paul Kennedy on the show talking about the rise and fall of great powers. He's a professor at Yale. He wrote a magnificent book of that title. And he pointed out that every empire went through the same trajectory that the United States is going through now. And early in the rise to power, they spend very little on war and they invest in their domestic economy. They get to the top and they start diverting all their resources to holding on and trying to forestall rivals from challenging their power. And as they do that, their real economy rots out. It happened most recently to the British Empire. It's happening to us now. And unless we become cognizant of what's happening and pull back from this empire, we're going to end up like the British and the Spanish empires before us, just a wreck with a lot of dead people and many years to recover.
Well, and you know, that's one of the things that we as a nation have to look at. We have to look at what the long-term effect of this imperialism will be. We also have to look at, you know, what the long-term cost will be. We have to look towards what kind of future we want to have. Because to be honest, and I hate to say this, but unless we act now, history shows that we will launch ourselves into another major conflagration, because that's what historically has happened to every empire. Britain could have backed down. They didn't. You know, Germany could have backed down. They didn't. Spain could have backed down. They didn't. Spain probably had the lightest fall out of all of them. But now what we're looking at, I mean, Britain lost millions. France lost millions.
Yeah, I mean,
Germany lost millions.
I mean, World War I and II were the price that Britain paid for its empire, and it was a bloody one. And the same with France. All of the young men that they lost in those wars. And what did they get for it, you know, these young men?
Exactly.
They died for an empire that wasn't worth it.
Exactly. And at least Britain in its defense got something out of its empire. We're paying almost $5 a gallon for gas. We're seeing no dividends. And we're in no position to fight another major war. We really aren't.
Hey, guys. We have Michelle from Sag Harbor on the phone.
Oh, hi, Michelle. Glad you joined us again.
Hi, yes. I have to go into class, and I'm already late.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But, just wanted to say thank you again for the show, because I really
have my eyes opened about things that I really wasn't aware of.
Well, thank you so much.
Definitely an Obama supporter. More him on the foreign policy mm-hmm. as well, because I was just more concerned with getting our troops out of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to comment of how really shocked I am to not know about what happened in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot believe that the media doesn't cover that. And just the only comment I have, I don't know what the answer is, but I was thinking that, you know, you were talking about the rise and fall of empires, and what I think is the bottom line is this is very scary because I think we're at a different time in history with the nuclear power that we have, and I think it's just very frightening.
The stakes are high.
Well, thank you very much for your call,
thank
Michelle.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle.
And, I think Michelle, again, makes a very good point. You know, I mean, looking at the stakes are a lot higher. I mean, what used to protect us was the fact that German bombers could never have the range to fly to the U.S. But the fact is that the Chinese are capable of launching a missile from a satellite and hitting New York or launching a missile from a submarine. And they say if Chinese submarines actually launched missiles from the U.S. coast, we'd have about 30 seconds of warning before they detonated in an American city. And we have no early warning systems. We have no air raid shelters. We have, you know, we had a very hard time coping with Hurricane Katrina, let alone a massive attack on the U.S. on U.S. soil.
We just have 6 minutes left in the show. You're listening to In Context Monthly War Report. If you'd like to join the conversation with Ken, Gus, and Marshawn, give us a ring at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756.
So we really have to realize that the stakes are very high. I mean, like I say, for the first time in U.S. history, we have the potential of being hit. Our seas used to protect us. They don't anymore. If somebody's a supporter of imperialism, that's fine. They're entitled to their opinion. But at least if you want to be an imperialist, do it right. Don't try to go to war with countries that are 10 times as strong as you with an army an eighth their size.
You know, Gus talked about the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, and that's really what set us off on this road. That combined with the Spanish-American War of 1898 – we were doing pretty well up until then. I mean, on our own with a foreign policy that we strove to be friendly with all nations and to go to war with nobody, just to develop our own economy and trade with everybody. And since the turn of the century, we've really went off the tracks.
All right, guys, this is John from Long Island.
Hi, John. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
I know the woman that just got off was an Obama supporter. I'd like to point out the fact that when Bush the Lesser left office, the U.S. accounted for about $15 billion in overseas arms sales. It retreated to about $14 billion immediately when Obama came in. And currently, the sales are up from $15 billion to $54 billion. Now, you know, all that money ends up in the hands of Raytheon, Halliburton, GE, and okay, it creates American jobs, but you have to realize that all those weapons and all that money, it ends up in a slush fund in the hands of client dictators who parcel it out to their underlings, which ends up in the hands of Al-Qaeda, out Taliban, let's call them.
Do you see anybody on the political scene who would reverse this policy whereby we become the number one arms dealer in the world? Is there anybody out there?
Whether we vote Republican or Democrat in this election is immaterial. It's Tweedledee, Tweedledum. Everybody should just, you know, open their eyes and just vote a third party no matter what, because, you know, we have $16 trillion in national debt to this country. We owe to who knows where. I never signed on for this debt. The Republicans and Democrats have both handed us this national debt.
Absolutely.
And it's all for this war profiteering. The war in Iraq is going to cost us about, according to Dennis Kucinich, about $3 billion by the time it's over. The Afghani war is up to about $1 trillion now. This incursion into Libya costs us about $1 billion.
Absolutely.
It's a massive transfer of wealth into the hands of a few, while we in America lack sufficient jobs, health care, housing, and even retirement.
Well, John, I think that, you know, we're on the same wavelength, and these are themes we really appreciate your raising. We have to go to another call, but thanks very much for calling, John. Bye-bye.
All right, thank you for your call.
This is Gene from Danbury.
Hi, Gene.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and I agree with the last gentleman that just spoke, and also I wanted to say that I think part of the solution for all of this, it would be to get our oil companies and large companies to switch over from oil-based fuels to other kinds of fuels, renewable resources,
mm-hmm.
and I think that, you know, they're afraid to do this because there's so much money in the oil right now. And really, we're in the Middle East doing all of these things because we want a slow takeover of the oil. And I believe that if we got into things like solar energy, wind energy, wave energy, geothermal energy, and they, you know, redirected their monies into those kinds of resources, that then these wars would not keep proliferating throughout forever and on and on and on.
It would seem to me that the conflict is what they make money on. So if you're proposing a peaceful future where we don't need to quibble over pockets of gas and oil out there, and you know, just by being in conflict, the military-industrial complex and the oil companies make money. So it seems like there is no way that they're going to allow us to go to peaceful sources of energy that don't cause conflict.
And I think that's that's the dangerous part, is the fact that, you know, if we could eliminate our dependency on natural resources, I mean on foreign oil and stuff, and or fossil fuels, that's the word I'm looking for, to eliminate our dependency on fossil fuels, become energy independent, and we wouldn't need this expansionism. We could have a policy of national protectionism, kind of like Switzerland has. You know, we still have trade relations with other countries, but we defend our borders. We don't need to expand. We don't need anybody else's help. We can be self-sufficient.
Thanks for calling, Gene. I think you've put your finger on this. Energy is central to this whole military situation we find ourselves in.
Absolutely.
I'm afraid
you hit it right on the money,
Gene. I'm afraid that's all we have time for the show. We're going to be going off the air. And coming on up next is Rick Petrone. We'll bring you jazz music. And reminder, we will be on in 2 weeks on the 8th with our next show. You've been listening to In Context. We're on Monday from noon to 1 p.m. on WPKN 89.5 FM, WPKN.org, or where we stream from. So we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Did you give out all the websites?
Oh, yeah. In Context Report. Go ahead, guys.
InContextReport.com.
Find us on Facebook.
You can find us on Facebook. Like us there and get updates on all the stories that we do and find podcasts. Like us on YouTube, youtube.com/InContextReport. And look for some new videos that we might be doing soon. And I guess that does it, right?
We'll be back
on in 2 weeks on the 8th, right?
On the 8th, Monday, noon to 1.
All right. We'll see you then.